watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, the conclusion of the three-part series of recordings from Democracy School with instructor Thomas Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, based in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. The presentation you're going to hear was given late last month in Camp Bell, New York, and was the first Democracy School held in the state. It was sponsored by members of the Green Party and the Finger Lakes Progressive Coalition, who, as a result of their experiences attending the three-day intensive course, have decided to sponsor the establishment of an ongoing series of democracy schools in New York State. At the end of the program, I'll give information as to how to become involved in that effort. For those who didn't hear the previous two programs, the purpose of Democracy School is to help communities to organize movements that will result in real democracy. That is, to dismantle the system of law that has been rigged from the beginning to insulate the rich and powerful from majority rule, thus denying the people self-determination, the right to decide how we live, where we live. Over the preceding 2 weeks, Lindsay has discussed how we came to realize that the regulatory system of permits, which is presented as a remedy to check the harm done by corporations to people and the environment, actually serves as a mechanism to deflect citizen challenges to corporate power. We have heard over the preceding weeks that corporate rule is an old problem, and that a central goal of the American revolutionists was freeing the people from oppressive crown-chartered corporations that dominated the lives of the inhabitants of the American colonies as well as the other colonies of the British Empire. We heard how after the Revolution, the Federalists betrayed the spirit of the Revolution as articulated by the Declaration of Independence by going behind closed doors to write the Constitution, and how it was framed to enable the development of a homegrown plutocracy by protecting the property rights of the rich over the human rights of the many, and that this expressed itself first in the slave system and then in the modern corporate system. This is why, Lindsay said, activists trying to protect their communities and the environment have seen the situation continually worsen in spite of their years of immense effort and widespread public support for their goals. They have not gotten to the root cause: who wields the Constitution against whom? We left off last week with a cliffhanger. Lindsay was telling the story of the efforts of citizens of Antrim, a rural Pennsylvania town, to prevent Waste Management Incorporated, the nation's largest trash hauler, from turning their town into a giant dump through an expansion of a landfill. They organized a citizens' group, A-Rage, went to their town government, and demanded that laws be enacted to remedy the various problems caused by the landfill operated by Waste Management Corporation. The town government responded by passing laws to govern the conduct of Waste Management's operations. The Waste Management Corporation then threatened to bring its vast financial and legal resources to bear against the small town for infringing on its so-called constitutional rights, rights that have been successively driven into law by the federal courts over the years, beginning with rulings in the late 1800s that found corporations to be persons under law. Finding these rights by interpreting constitutional amendments that were designed to protect the rights of former slaves. We heard how these same courts ruled that this principle of, quote, equal protection did not apply to the rights of women to vote or otherwise function as equal persons in society. The question of judge-made law is particularly timely, as the same old rhetoric condemning so-called judicial activism has been emanating from the supporters on Capitol Hill of the reactionary Supreme Court nominee John Roberts. Because the Supreme Court is involved in interpreting the Constitution, judicial activism is what they do all day long. The rhetoric notwithstanding, judges interpret the Constitution in light of their pre-existing worldview, and that has, in the course of U.S. history, usually been on the side of private wealth, reflecting the class biases of judges who are deeply invested in the system and who are prime beneficiaries of it. Democracy School strips bare the mystification that our laws have anything to do with some abstract concept of justice, of right, or fairness. No, no. The laws reflect who has the power in the society, and Democracy School is about adopting a strategy for bringing that power home to people and communities. We heard last week how the Antrim Town Board caved into the threats of litigation made by Waste Management Corporation, and thus set aside the laws they passed in response to demands of their citizens, a situation sadly more the rule than the exception in rural America. The outraged citizens came to CELDEF. We begin as Lindsay explains what happened next.
They came to us and they said, "We did everything right. We did everything we were taught to do in civics class. We were taught to become public, active citizens. We exercised our freedom of speech, our freedom of assembly to come together, to stitch together this group. We gave testimony. We petitioned government for a redress of grievances. We exercised our constitutional rights. We did everything right, and we still got screwed." That's what they said. They said, "Isn't there something else we can do?" And I said, "Well, you know, we've been playing around with some of this charter revocation stuff. And as part of the group's research," because they really love data, and we all love data, they really got into the data, "they had 300 pages of research on Waste Management Corporation, 300 pages of environmental regulatory violations that had been committed by the corporation in the state of Pennsylvania over the past 20 years. So we went back to the Pennsylvania Charter Revocation Statute, and we said, well, if this isn't misusing the charter, I don't know what is. 300 pages of environmental regulatory violations over the past 20 years. Surely that rises to the standard under the charter revocation law of revoking the charter for misusing the charter. Because no charter gives you the right to break the law. Charter can't give you the right to break the law." So we said, maybe we should do something with this. Instead of throwing up our hands and going home, which is what most folks do, most community groups flatten out and go home, maybe we should take this someplace else. And so we went to the Attorney General of the state, and we made our case, and we said, "It's your duty, not just something you should do, it's your duty. This corporation is causing harm to the citizens of this community. It's your duty to revoke the charter of this corporation." Okay? Because this charter is operating and misusing not only its charter, but abusing people who live around its facilities. And the Attorney General said, "Take a hike." He said, "We don't use the charter revocation statute. That's for the regulatory agencies to deal with. You need to take your complaint to the Department of Environmental Protection, DEP, and I'll set up a meeting with you with their chief counsel, yeah, so you can sit down and talk about this stuff." Yeah. Shunting us into the regulatory process and away from some of this direct control. So our group, which is mostly A-Rage groups, mostly feisty women, who said, "We want to take this into a higher level," we decided to sue the Attorney General of the state. To say to the Attorney General, "It's your duty under the law as the chief elected law enforcement officer for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to bring a charter revocation action in this case." And so we sued the state and we sued the Attorney General. Well, on Christmas Eve of that year, I get a call from Waste Management Counsel's office, who informs me that the corporation is going to intervene in the case. Become a party in the case, because they feel that their interests were threatened to become a party to the case. And so that started a fascinating cycle in which the corporation attempted to intervene, become a party in this litigation, which was originally just between the citizens of the state and their chief elected law enforcement officer, to force him to do what he should have been doing anyway, That's essentially what the case was about. Now, back in that day, we were very impatient. We're pretty impatient now. But back then, you know, we dredged up this statute. It hadn't been used in 40 or 50 years. And we said to the court, this case is so clear. It's crystal clear. Here's the statute. Here's the environmental regulatory violations. It's clear. There's no need to argue about any of this stuff. You need to issue a judgment for us now. And so we made a motion for what's called peremptory judgment. It's a little used part of the rules, court rules in Pennsylvania, where if you think that the issue is clear and there's no debate about it, that you can ask the court to order immediately to say that this is the duty and to order the public official to carry out that duty. At the same time that we were moving towards that, getting a court hearing to get the judge to issue a ruling on that peremptory judgment, Waste Management Corporation was attempting to push their way into the case. So that's the framework or the structure that this takes place in. Richard and I wrote the brief for the court. And what we wrote, we still go back and look at today, and in fact use pieces of it for some of the other things that we've done, because we think it was that groundbreaking. And what we wrote here was that, at the top of page 35, the role of the judiciary in granting expanded rights to corporations over the past century instills a responsibility in this court to remedy grievances brought against corporations. Towards the bottom of that column. Many bestowals of rights and privileges upon corporations occurred several generations ago and have been absorbed into legal lore and accepted, their origins forgotten or simply neglected. These bestowals and their diverse impacts on ensuing generations do not appear to be the subjects of sustained, intense debate within the legal community. From this lack of debate, it may appear to this court that such matters relating to the rights and privileges of the modern corporation are not the subject of sustained, intense debate among the people of this commonwealth and this country. It is the plaintiff's contention that, in fact, the citizens of this country during this century have been engaged in passionate and sustained debate about the rights and powers of corporations, on the proper nature of corporations in a democracy, on what should be the relationship between the sovereign people of each state and the fiction which is the modern giant corporation. Skipping down to that last paragraph. This debate is perhaps better known in the form of citizen resistance to corporate decisions to produce and use toxic chemicals in great quantities, to favor particular forms of energy production over others, to invest in chemical and energy-intensive agriculture, to favor the internal combustion engine and individual motor vehicles over mass transit. Hey, we were on a roll. To pursue destructive forest practices both on public land and land owned by paper corporations, to create the savings and loan debacle, and to site toxic factories or dumps. Skipping over to the next column, the plaintiffs believe that this court has a special responsibility when petitioned by citizens of this commonwealth for redress for injuries caused by the corporation. Last paragraph. Over the past century, the courts have narrowed the spectrum of available legal remedies against the corporation and the injuries that it causes. To now further narrow that avenue and declare that the power of the Attorney General when presented with a factual petition that addresses a history of lawbreaking is completely discretionary is to relieve citizens of one of their last control mechanisms over the artificial creature called the corporation. What did Waste Management have to say about all this? Well, before we had the hearing about whether or not they'd be allowed to intervene in the case, they filed this brief. And the brief is fascinating because it was our first experience with getting a brief from corporate counsel that essentially laid out exactly these themes that we have been talking about during the course of the democracy school. First thing they argued was that the charter revocation remedy was archaic. It's an archaic holdover from days before the regulatory system emerged. And so they make arguments like, on page 38, numerous alternate legal remedies exist that should operate to bar the plaintiff's case on charter revocation. That there are numerous and duplicative remedies available to citizens' groups. And then they were so nice on page 39 in the footnote to list those remedies. Okay? That's what we were talking about last night, about being channeled. We have the Environmental Hearing Board Act, the Solid Waste Management Act, the Infectious and Chemotherapeutic Waste Disposal Act, the Hazardous Sites Cleanup Act, the Clean Streams Law, the Federal Clean Water Act, Federal Clean Air Act, RCRA, CERCLA, all these good citizen environmental laws that they were arguing had replaced or supplanted the charter revocation remedy. That's Waste Management folks. But Waste Management Corporation and their attorneys went on. They said, Actually, granting the relief requested will ensure future problems for industry in Pennsylvania. Petitioner's request for the extraordinary remedies of quo warranto, I think it's the first time we forced them to use the word quo warranto, against the Attorney General will, if granted, lead to actions by other citizen groups who harbor individual grievances against all industry in Pennsylvania, including the waste transportation and disposal industry. Waste management and chemical waste management fear that granting the relief request in this case will open the floodgates to other frivolous litigation initiated by citizens groups and individuals who allege personal injury as well as public harm from the, quote, legitimate business activities of these entities. Okay. So notice the shell game when they talk about that.
They took care of all those 22,000 violations.
Yeah, they publicly made that in front of the judge. They said this 300-page booklet actually showed that the regulatory system worked because they got caught for those 300 pages, that someone noticed that they had broken the law, and that therefore the regulatory system worked because they had taken steps to remedy each of those individual harms through the regulatory system, through paying a fine or doing this, that, or the other. Once again, just to press it home, they say, ironically, a victory by the petitioners could result in a greater harm to the public because a dissolution of the corporations in Pennsylvania would create problems with waste disposal, leaving much of the state without adequate waste collection and processing services. It is doubtful that the petitioners at the time the complaint was filed envisioned this impact on the Commonwealth. Thanks, Dad. Thus, this court must carefully consider the consequences of granting petitioners' request for relief, both on the corporations and on the public health and safety of the citizens and business community of Pennsylvania. So what happened? Well, the briefs were filed, and everything was condensed into one day, the hearings. The judge had set a hearing on the intervention of the corporation into the case to decide whether they'd be allowed in or not first. Second was a hearing on our petition to actually grant us the remedy or deny us the remedy. That was second. Okay, so what happened? What happened in the case? Well, we started out, Waste Management flew their counsel in, put him up on the stand.
He was not asleep this time?
He was not asleep this time. And was examined by the Waste Management attorney. Essentially, they tried to say that they would be injured by this action because they would have to include it within their quarterly reports with the SEC, that this action was ongoing and it could have an impact on the profits of the corporation as a disclosure item, and therefore could have impacted them and stockholders, people not buying their stock or selling stock or whatever. We got up and cross-examined him for about an hour and a half. It was really fun. We didn't have expectations, so we were all over the place. I was asking him what a corporation was, why a corporation had constitutional rights, why should they be able to intervene in this case. I mean, we were all over the place. We have the transcripts still from this hearing. It's fascinating stuff. And in the end, to our surprise, the judge prevented the corporation from intervening in the case. He issued a ruling against the company, holding that this was a case between the citizens of the Commonwealth and their chief elected law enforcement officer. If Waste Management wanted a chance to defend themselves, they would have that chance later on if the Attorney General brought charter revocation actions against the company. So at that point, Waste Management Corporation was out of the case. He threw them out. And the Waste Management attorneys very quickly moved for a recess of about 10 minutes, and the judge granted it. And I'll never forget, I was at the counsel table on the left, they were on the counsel table on the right, was the Waste Management corporate attorneys huddled with the Attorney General of the state, instructing him how to argue the case.
That's in the room in front of everybody?
Yes, in front of everybody. In essence, the fact is that we're left in a position of begging and pleading people to do their job.
Yeah.
And that's not what movements are built on. They're built on something else, and they're built on force, and using the law as force. Richard, when he does this, he puts up buttons. He actually draws a page of little buttons. When we try to do something, we don't have buttons we can push where somebody else does the work. But the corporate boys, when they want to do something, they got all the buttons to push. They can push a button and the Attorney General shows up. They push a button and the agency shows up to defend something or the other to stop you from doing something. They push another button and the cops show up. You know, when the folks sat down in the old growth forest, who rubbed pepper spray in their eyes? It was the sheriff, excuse my language, of Humboldt County, a public official rubbing pepper spray in their eyes because they were on private property owned by the company. So when they push a button, the sheriff shows up. I mean, that's what it means about a corporate state. It means about having buttons to push and other people do the work. The state does the heavy lifting. Okay? We don't have those buttons. That's part of the problem. Love the problem. Well, we did an hour and a half oral argument in front of the judge. We got into talking. He was a former legislator who I know quite well at this point, Judge Kelly. We went back and forth for an hour and a half about corporations and corporations being persons and the history of corporations, all that stuff. Didn't matter a whit because he issued a 13-page ruling which said essentially that the Attorney General had unfettered discretion about whether or not to bring a charter revocation suit and compared it to prosecutorial discretion, which is essentially untrammeled, unfettered, in that he has the absolute discretion to decide when, if, or whether to bring a charter revocation suit. An interesting side note is that Tom Corbett was the Attorney General of the state at that time. Tom Corbett, 6 months later, went to work for Waste Management to head up their good government division.
Now, isn't of course. This,
How interesting.
And we're told that that was where they met, that we arranged the meeting because that was the first time the company had ever met Corbett. So.
Isn't there also a provision in Pennsylvania law that's similar to New York that if the Attorney General rules decided not to take this, that the governor of the state of New York has the right to make the decision?
No, we don't have that provision. Yeah. And of course, in this case, probably would have made a difference, but it would have been another tactical.
Would that be Tom Ridge at the time?
Tom Ridge or his lieutenant, whoever that was. Yeah. So the fact is that we did a number of things wrong. And one of the things we did wrong was that we didn't have 500 people in the courtroom. Okay. Doing it again, we would pack the courtroom because nothing happens without that. Not that it would have changed things, but it was a different
way to work. Can you elucidate that a little bit? And why do you feel the more masses of people would have helped the decision?
Well, I'm not sure if it would have helped the decision, but it would have been a way to mass educate 500 people at a time, mm-hmm. bringing them through the courtroom to see how it actually works. Because there's a lot of mystique about courts and about secret language and about, you know, the priestesses and priests of the law. It's kind of like the church in a way, the attorneys and officers of the court operate. And so bringing people through there and jamming the court with 500 people not only would have allowed us to educate the people, but also our judges are elected on the Commonwealth Court. And so it was a way of doing things and using the court as an organizing tool. I mean, we raised this yesterday that, you know, by and large, our community, our liberal, whatever you want to call it, progressive, environmental, labor community, still turns to the court for remedies. And real movements understand that the courts will not help the movement to form. They will step in to stop it from forming. But we still, you know, we put our coats on and go home whenever the court rules on something. They say, oh, well, the court's ruled. It's time to go home. We've heard. They've delivered the ruling. It's an opinion. Can't do anything about it. Let's go home. We've got to live with it. Well, where does that leave us? If we give legitimacy to the courts to shut down our movement building before we move it, build a critical mass, that we need to do something. So with that understanding, it's about bouncing off the courts. That's the phrase that we give it now. If we know the court's going to rule a certain way, how do we use the court as a strategic mechanism to educate and organize people so that the court's decree will automatically accelerate the organizing that we're doing? It's almost putting ourselves in a position where we can't lose. And what does that organizing look like? You have people in Pennsylvania now questioning the role of the courts in coming in to shut things down. And eventually it's going to come down to how many people put up their middle finger to the court when they put out a decree and they see it as illegitimate in some ways. I mean, that's prefiguring a lot of stuff where we're going to be this afternoon, but that's pretty much the job, is to build the army. And yeah,
I would just like to point out that what David passed out this morning about the four people in Ithaca and they're asking folks to jam that courtroom both inside and out is exactly what we're talking about here.
And we forget the civil rights movement, that the sit-in protesters drove close to 5,000 cases into the courts. Their job, you know, and the early attorneys that were helping them out, who understood that they were less attorneys and more organizers, their job was to overload the dockets of the federal courts in the lower courts so that the Supreme Court and the higher courts had to do something to give a remedy to those folks. And it's about using the courts, not with some magical legal argument thinking that we can put the best language in a legal document and a brief is going to sway someone, there's going to be a ruling made. That may happen from time to time. But routinely, the courts have developed, enforced, validated, and vindicated 200 years of corporate rights about giving rights, bestowing rights on a few people to make governing decisions for the many and for communities in this country. That's the sad, stark state of affairs that we're in. And if we think a court or a judge is going to reverse 200 years of property law and commerce law and contracts law to deliver a remedy to 20 people around a kitchen table fighting off something wants to come into the community, we're freaking crazy. Because it's not going to happen. And so the question is, how do we fashion and stitch the courts with decisions we know that they're going to make into our own organizing? Because otherwise we're headed into a dead end. And the light at the end of the tunnel is an oncoming train. I mean, essentially, because we're about ready to get hit. And we have been hit.
Let me get this straight. This is tangential, perhaps, to the immediate discussion, but we're wasting our energies not only on the court system, but as I read the material, we're also wasting our energies in the political process of oppression light or oppression heavy in the political parties, are we not?
I don't know. I
mean, you don't want to commit to that.
Well, I've been a Green Party candidate. We took over our county Democratic Party and wrote some of the stuff into the county platform in Franklin County. I've been a Republican because we ran a Republican county commissioner candidate because we're 80% Republican registered and 20% Democrat. So if you want to get elected, you have to do the Republican dance. I mean, I've been all over the political spectrum. And I'm not sure if it matters. I think these tags that we have, they just don't matter anymore. It's about communities and people that care about communities, no matter what their label is. I mean, that's pretty much where I'm at. We've thrown elected officials out in at least 15 different townships in Pennsylvania where we had boards of supervisors that wouldn't listen. It wouldn't do what a majority of people wanted. So we threw them out. But there was no affiliation with party, really. I mean, it was whatever was convenient to run on at the time to take power in that community. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where it drives up from. I mean, I used to have a lot of hope for the Greens. I have less hope now, but there's some real quality people within the Greens that we've used and have worked with us to do this work. There are also quality people in the Republican Party because local control is a Republican tenet. Mm-hmm. And in Pennsylvania, this work is about local control. So it crosses the line there. The Democrats have sold us down the river in Pennsylvania. Governor Ed Rendell signed the bill that stripped away community rights to control factory farms without hesitation. You know, so where do you turn? Well, you have to build your own constituency. I don't think there's any ready-made constituency out there for this stuff. It's all got to be fabricated from scratch, which makes it all the much harder.
But Justice Stevens recently stated that he disagreed with his own opinions, even when he wrote the majority opinion, because he is not a legislator, he is a judge, and the Constitution requires him to. And these opinions were like the taking of private land by private companies, things like that. And he disagreed with it. He said legislation is where you change those things, not the courts.
Yeah, and with all, I was going to say due respect, but maybe not, to Justice Stevens, the fact is, why should we spend our entire lives trying to convince Justice Stevens to do something different? In other words, beg and plead Justice Stevens with the right briefs and the right legal arguments to do something different. That's not our job. Our job is to create a movement that eventually forces those institutions to respect and recognize the vision of the movement for the type of world that we want to build. Not that we want to build, but that we have to build. Because we don't have any choice. And we're running out of time. I mean, I think everybody in this room probably agrees with that. And the fact is, who gives a shit what Justice Stevens says? Most of the Supreme Court justices come out of Yale and Harvard. I mean, where do we think those people's values are formed? Do you think they worry about how to pay an electric bill? You think they've worried how to pay an electric bill their whole life? They have no clue. They have different value systems that go into the making of law than us. Yeah. So why should we care what Justice Stevens says? I mean, I hear you. I hear what you have to say. But the fact is, I more and more, I screw them.
Well, but he's saying that you don't get what you want from the courts.
Yes.
All right, you have to go to legislation,
yes.
You have to change the legislation, you have to change the government.
Yes, and the only way legislation is passed, the only way court decisions come down is if there's a movement in the streets
right.
with some kind of ferment brewing.
I challenge anybody to find a court ruling in favor of the people where there weren't people getting blood in the streets.
Absolutely, yes.
All right. These people, the corporations are dealing with themselves and this elite group also. So don't, isn't there information or, you know, court cases that you can use in their dealings with themselves where they want to treat each other as equals that you can use to balance, sort of bring your group into that same fold?
Well, the question is how we want to do that. I mean, sometimes in the democracy schools, echoing some of what Diane said last night, was that corporations have these rights. We need to get those rights, so maybe we should incorporate. And then we have those rights. Well, the issue is the rights don't really flow from the structure. They flow from wealth. The accumulated wealth and property and capital that agglomerates within the corporate form. Now, the structure itself gives you limited liability and some other things, but you, Joe, and I, going out and forming a corporation, thinking that we're going to have the same rights on paper we may, but we can't enforce them or validate them because we don't have the wealth to do so, like a waste management corporation. It takes both. But even falling short of that is that without the wealth to do that, wealth is what motivates it. It's really just a structure without the wealth, and so that's what pushes it. And that's what gets us to questions of class. I mean, we don't really talk about this in our democracy school, but we do call it a corporate class. You know, homeless people don't have corporations. Right? Corporations are used for a specific purpose, and they're used for a specific purpose by a specific class. And tying back into the slave system concept, when we had a slave system, now we have a corporate system. It's about a certain class being able to push the buttons to have the state do the heavy lifting for them. It's about a few using the law to govern the many, and to put it in another paraphrase, it's about who wields the Constitution against whom. Who wields the Constitution against whom? Okay. That's what it comes down to.
Well, with reference to being a stockholder, which probably most everybody in this room is in some way.
Yeah.
Most everybody.
Yeah.
Corporations do not have to be as bad as they are. And it's not necessarily the case that a corporation can't make profits and do make products and make profits off of them, that they necessarily have to be as bad as they are. We used to have a country where corporations made steel, and now they just steal. You have executives that, we have so many cases here with Enron and the WorldCom, and it just goes on and on, most of whom have not been perquarked because of the reduction of the controls upon corporate crime during the Clinton administration. Who's the Connecticut Senator, Raymond Gore?
Lieberman.
Lieberman was the spearhead behind watering down that regulation so that a lot of these guys that should have been indicted weren't. Corporations can be tamed and we need to change the regulation around from regulating us to regulating corporations.
I disagree. I think that the accommodationist view has been used by a lot of national level environmental groups to do that very thing, and all it's done is perpetuate their power with this aura that something substantial has been done to change it, but it hasn't changed, it's gotten worse. The Environmental Defense Fund, National Resources Defense Council, two prominent groups that fought against the sludging of America because they were going to make an accommodation with these people that were taken every chemical known to humankind in sludge and spreading on our fields to raise our food. And I don't think we've got the power to make that kind of accommodation to change them. I think it has to be that we remove the power that we granted them in the first place and then refuse to grant it again.
or to
I totally agree. We need a total systemic change in order to achieve that. We're nowhere close to that now.
But accommodation, taking a piece of what they're doing now and changing it and making it feel better, I don't think that
we're
works.
We're on the same page.
Okay.
Well, wait a minute.
Tom,
but it's,
then
I was going to say, it's the liability.
Tom first, and then Lynn. Sorry.
My question goes to where this is all going. If you remove the constitutional rights of corporations and their contract rights, certainly people would not put their money in corporations. They're no longer protected. And so the purpose of the corporation sort of dissolves. Where does that money go then?
Well,
do you have a better system after it's gone out of the corporations? And presumably you have individuals with that same amount of money and presumably the same amount of power.
Well, I think we get to a point where sometimes we fall into this, without corporations we wouldn't have toilet paper. Kind of thing that's come up in some democracy schools that
follow that out.
Well, people do the work in the corporations. Corporations are just an accumulation of property and capital. There's never been a corporation that made 10 pounds of steel. It's people. It's workers that make steel. Those where they have the knowledge base and the skills to make steel. Corporation is just a shell entity. It's an artificial entity used to agglomerate property and capital. Essentially to run those industries. Before corporations came along, we had guilds. We had all kinds of different types of ownership entities and business entities that did just fine. The money for investment will always flow to the investment that brings in the most percentage of return.
To which investment?
To people who want to invest.
I mean,
people always invest.
If you want to invest your money, will you give it to an individual and say, here, I'll loan this to you?
If that's the only option, yeah.
Smart guy.
Yeah, you give it to a guild or a partnership. We have other entities that operate that aren't incorporated.
Then haven't you created another accumulation of wealth right there that does the same thing with the corporation?
Well, part of that takes us to this part two of this conversation, which is the fact that if we're going to deal with corporations as being agglomerated pockets of capital and wealth beyond the control of people to make decisions to govern them, then what's the difference between that and very wealthy people who, without the corporate form, which doesn't happen today, the wealthy folks operate through the corporate form to do projects. You won't have a strip mine project done by an individual. It won't be Tom applying for the permit. It'll be the corporation applying for the permit because it comes with privileges when you do that. It comes with a shield when you do that through the corporate form. So eventually, do we have to deal with the fact that justice is meted out differently depending on what your wealth is? I think the answer is yes. We do have to deal with that. That's a ways down the road. We've got other problems to deal with up front first. What does that mean? I don't know. But we all know, knee-jerk, that your ability to participate in government is contingent on how much money you have and how much wealth you possess. That's just reality here in this United States. And so to really deal with these issues, we got to get to the core of that stuff. What that means, we don't pretend to know. What we do know at this point is that exponentially squared, corporations are sites where wealthy folks, rich people, accumulate that wealth and property to make governing decisions. And that has to be the first nexus that we really aim at. And that's the point of some of this organizing. There's very good questions about going back to the other place. But,
Tom, let me see if I understand. You're saying that pursuing regulatory agencies through the courts is meaningless or not going to win. I think so far what you said is pursuing this kind of thing in court is also not necessarily going to win. You're looking at it as an educational tool. Am I getting this, or is there any strategy that leads us to some sort of legal win down the road, or are we only talking about base building? Because I can think of 10 or 15 different ways to do base building other than getting 500 people to court to hope that they will see the inner disease of the system.
Hold those horses back.
Okay.
This afternoon.
Is that okay? Great.
About how folks are actually using this stuff.
Good.
This is just the bedrock.
Thank
but
you.
It's also not me telling you anything. It's folks last night have gone through how they've lived this stuff. This should never be about me saying that the regulatory system isn't working. It's your experience.
No, but you're making a presentation here. I'm talking about what the topic you're presenting. But that's fine. That's all I wanted to know.
Okay. Other questions before we close out this section?
Yeah.
Before we get a thunderstorm. Oh, Lynn, I'm sorry. You were after Tom.
It seems to me that the worst part of the whole corporate entity is the liability and that shields individual actors from any sort of legal consequences. And I'm wondering, has anybody, if you're going to use the legal system, try to use criminal laws to go against the actors for, like, for example, in Vicky's story, by the time they got through with their project, everybody that worked at the place was dead. They were deliberately poisoned, trying to bring charges for murder and conspiracy to murder and whatever against, you know, these various persons who ran that company and that kind of thing. Has anybody looked into that?
Well, when you have criminal sanctions, it's after the fact. In other words, the damages occur, and then you're trying to fix them or remedy them with money. Oh. We think that the approach is front-ended more. In other words, these home rule charters that we're starting to work with, I mean, what happens when people start to define corporations in a much different way? Not regulate, but define them as to what attributes they have at the local level and which ones would be allowed to do business or not, and writing that into law. I think that becomes much more powerful. Yeah.
I just need to correct that. I think either you misunderstood or I said it wrong, but the people that died were the people that worked in the original factory, not the people that were brought in to clean up the site.
Doesn't actually matter.
Okay.
Whoever it was that died, they died so these, excuse my language, could stuff their bulging pockets with more money, right?
Right.
They killed these people.
Right.
And
they
that's
knew,
why they did it.
And
they
knew that
they were
killing
doing
it,
and they didn't care. Because those people were nothing, right? So
well,
that's why,
part of,
you know, it's like, and that's...
Those
and
people were
workers.
Something. Those people were something to the corporation. They were workers. They were drones, and they were expendable because there were a whole lot more out there, and it's not all that different than what the slave system was.
No.
The corporate system is not all that different because all of us are workers to fill their pockets.
I hope this isn't really frivolous, because I think that there's something serious underneath, possibly, but is it possible for great masses of people to incorporate under, like, as a party to regain their rights of personhood? I mean, where they have tremendous combined wealth, property, certainly voting power. Would they be able to work out a more equal plane if they were able to do that?
Well, technically, that's what a corporation is. Shareholders are great masses of people who own the corporations.
Yes, but I'm talking about the governed. The masses of disenfranchised people, if they got together and incorporated.
But without money.
Yeah.
Well, they have money if they're enough of them. They give money to all kinds of causes. Look at all the causes and things they give money to, not to mention state lotteries. Imagine all that state lottery.
What's that?
I won't be
okay, David, and then we got to finish off this section and then take a break.
Well, recently we have an example of just how ineffective the courts are and the federal government is in reining in the corporate misbehavior. The federal government filed a suit against tobacco companies using RICO laws. And to my knowledge, that is still in the judge's hands. They've finished the case and the judge is considering it. But going into that phase of the trial, the end phase, there was an article which stated that the tobacco companies basically cannot be held liable for actions which they took in the past, which they are not doing now. Under these laws, as long as they stop doing the crimes they did before, they can't be fined now. Now you try that.
Yeah.
You try going out and doing some crime and then say, well, I'm not going to do it anymore, so don't punish me.
I'm not speeding anymore, officer. I'm stopped. Okay, hang on to your hats. We're going to move through this fairly quickly and then take a short break, stretch break, and then come back and do people's movements. On page 43 of your materials is an excerpt from a book called Unequal Protection, written by an individual named Tom Hartman. The book, Unequal Protection, essentially focuses on a court case called Southern Pacific Railroad versus Santa Clara County, which is in California. Southern Pacific Railroad, one of the big railroad companies, that for 20 years, 15 or 20 years prior to this case, which was 1886 when it was decided, following the Civil War up until 1886, the railroad companies drove through their lawyers and law firms into the courts this concept that corporations were persons for purposes of the Constitution. In other words, the protections, constitutional protections afforded to real, living, breathing, natural people like us, corporations contended that they were persons as well, protected by Bill of Rights protections and the Constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in 1886 essentially capped 15 to 20 years of driving into the courts on various cases arguing that corporations were persons under the law and protected by the Constitution. Won't get into the details of the case. This specific case, the Santa Clara case, was about taxation of fences, believe it or not, that the county wanted to tax fences owned by the railroad corporations. The railroad corporations contended that the taxes to be imposed on them were different from taxes imposed on other corporations or on people, and therefore it violated the railroad corporations' equal protection rights under the 14th Amendment, which are afforded only to people or persons, essentially our right to be treated equally with everybody else. That's what the Equal Protection Clause means. Corporations, the railroad corporations are arguing that they are persons, therefore protected by the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, and therefore the county couldn't differently tax the railroad corporations than they were taxing other corporations or people. That's the thumbnail. We include this selection to show that this concept of corporate personhood, as it's come to be known, was actually part of a lively debate during the late 1800s. This wasn't just judges and lawyers meeting in dust, smoky rooms making decisions about corporations being persons. It was a public debate. Representing Santa Clara County was an attorney named Delphin Delmas. He was one of us. He argued in front of the California legislature to protect the remaining redwoods in California. So he was a municipal lawyer, had some of the same values that we have, and essentially worked on behalf of municipalities as a solicitor. He was the attorney that represented Santa Clara County in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. As Tom Hartman notes on page 45 of your materials, actually it's not 45, it is 47, he says, no laws were passed by Congress granting that corporations should be treated the same under the Constitution as living, breathing human beings, and none have been passed since then. This was judge-made law. At its uppermost insane essence was that courts decreeing or finding corporations in the Constitution. Keeping in mind that corporations were not persons for 100 years after the ratification of the Constitution. By law, they were not treated as persons. You read the Constitution, you can't find the word corporation in it. It's not there. And so for 100 years, corporations did business, but were not persons having the privilege of personhood or rights of personhood. So to read some of Delphin's oral argument, page 51, to show what kind of language is being used, halfway down that page on 51, he argued in front of the court that this law was intended to establish equality between men in their individual capacity, apologies to women, and had no reference to equality between men and corporations, is too plain for argument. He's talking about the 14th Amendment. The law took the rights of a white citizen as the standard of measurement and simply commanded that the rights of all other citizens, whatever their race or color, should be equal to his. The next page, page 53 of your materials at the top, in front of the court, Delmas argued, to attain and accomplish all these ends in all the states is, I conceive, in some degree, the object of the 14th Amendment. Its mission was to raise the humble, the downtrodden, and the oppressed to the level of the most exalted upon the broad plane of humanity, to make man the equal of man, but not to make the creature of the state, the bodiless, soulless, and mystic creature called a corporation, the equal of the creature of God. Argument in front of the court. Supreme Court, of course, did not listen to Domus. The Supreme Court issued many rulings over the past years after Santa Clara. There are actually 67 different Supreme Court cases in which they validate and vindicate the concept that corporations are persons for purposes of constitutional protections. Now, what has that meant over the years? Well, on page 54, intended as a resource document for graduates of the Democracy School, we spared you the 65 pages and just excerpted this section, which is essentially, like I said, a resource document. This is taken from our model legal brief to eliminate corporate rights, which we drafted last year, which has been filed in many federal courts as a friend of the court brief, essentially arguing that corporations having the rights of persons for constitutional reasons violates the fundamental founding framework of these United States because it eliminates consent of the governed and makes a mockery over majority rule and some of these other concepts that are throughout the Constitution and Declaration of Independence on the documents. Next, we go to the Bill of Rights, because, of course, the Bill of Rights are the first 10 of Bill of Rights are the first 10 amendments. So starting with the First Amendment on page 61, corporations now have First Amendment rights. In the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. We talk about a case called First National Bank of Boston versus Bellotti. This was a case in Massachusetts where the state of Massachusetts had adopted a law prohibiting corporations from spending money on referenda. In other words, eliminating corporations from the referenda process. U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and said, can't do that, violates corporations' First Amendment rights, and they threw out the law as well as the laws of 29 other states that had eliminated corporations from the referenda process. This is not ancient history. This is 1978. That's when the Bellotti case was decided. The First Amendment rights. Moving on to the Fourth Amendment. Just a primer. Fourth Amendment, of course, eliminates unreasonable searches and seizures. That's what the Fourth Amendment is as it is written. The U.S. Supreme Court has found corporations in the Fourth Amendment. A case called Hale versus Henkel, which was in 1906, in which, looking at some page 64 of your materials, thank you, Fred, up top, where the court nullified a grand jury subpoena issued under the Sherman Antitrust Act during an investigation into price-fixing actions of the tobacco companies. U.S. Supreme Court quashed the subpoena, calling it an unreasonable search and seizure, and applied Fourth Amendment protections to corporations. My favorite case under Fourth Amendment is on footnote 41 at the bottom of page 64, Dow Chemical Corporation versus the United States. EPA flew planes over Dow Chemical's manufacturing facilities to ensure compliance with the Clean Air Act. Dow Chemical Corporation sued the EPA, contending that it violated the corporation's Fourth Amendment rights because the overflights were searches and seizures under the Fourth Amendment. The court, while ruling on behalf of the EPA, did so because they determined that the overflights weren't searches or seizures, but they still validated the concept that corporations have Fourth Amendment rights. In other words, they played with the definition of search and seizure rather than going after Fourth Amendment rights of corporations. Fifth Amendment, starting on page 65 of your materials. Supreme Court has found corporations in the Fifth Amendment under a case called Noble versus Union River Logging Railroad Company in 1893. On the next page, 66, we have this case we always like because of the name, Fong Fu versus the United States, cited in 1962, in which the double jeopardy clause was bestowed on corporations. Of course, double jeopardy, prohibiting a retrial or a double suit against an individual person under the Constitution. Double jeopardy clause now accrues to corporations as well. Next page, finding corporations of contracts and commerce clauses on page 67 of your materials. You'll see our old friend trustees of Dartmouth College at the top about the contracts clause being applied to corporations and the contracts rights becoming corporate rights. Then we talk about the commerce clause at the top of page 68. Essentially, the commerce clause reads that only Congress shall have the power to regulate interstate commerce. Commerce clause has been applied to corporations to overturn things like out-of-state trash bans passed by states like Virginia, who said we don't want out-of-state trash coming in to fill up our landfills. Waste Management Corporation sued and overturned the out-of-state waste ban, contending that trash was commerce, and therefore the state could not interfere with commerce. which of course leads to the dormant Commerce Clause, which says that even if Congress hasn't spoken on an issue, that the states or local governments are forbidden from speaking on that issue or making law on that issue as well. You have the Commerce Clause that says, essentially, if Congress has passed a law dealing with regulating interstate commerce in a certain area, it's off limits to the states or other governments. But then we have this fascinating thing that the courts have read into it called the Negative or Dormant Commerce Clause, which says that even if Congress hasn't acted, that states and governments can't pass law in that area, and that the courts can step in to overturn those laws passed by state and other governments. This is another attempt to put things in a chronological order and just to point out some things in the timeline to draw everything together that we talked about in this corporate rights perspective. 1789, you have ratification of the U.S. Constitution. 1819 appears the Dartmouth College case that we talked about in terms of corporations getting rights under the Contracts Clause and the Charter becoming a contract. You have Minor versus Happersett, that infamous case that we discussed earlier, in which women as a class brought a case in 1874 under the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, contending that the Equal Protection Clause conferred upon them the right to vote. The U.S. Supreme Court said, no, 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 silly women, silly ladies, go back. The 14th Amendment says no such thing, and therefore you don't fall under its protections. Yet, of course, in 1886, we have the Santa Clara case in which corporations, the U.S. Supreme Court bestowed equal protection due process rights on corporations, and corporations became people before women became people. 1889 is the Minneapolis case, also person, corporations are persons for due process and equal protection. 1893 is the Noble versus Union River logging case. That's the Fifth Amendment case that we went over. 1906, Hale versus Henkel, that's the Fourth Amendment protections that we talked about. 1908, Armor Packing Company. Corporations have also been bestowed Sixth Amendment rights to a jury trial, that corporate defendants are accused and therefore they're entitled to a jury trial in a criminal case. 1922, fascinating case of Pennsylvania Coal Company versus Mahan. Pennsylvania legislature passes a law that says that the coal companies have to leave pillars of coal in place so that mine subsidence doesn't occur, because we had houses and still do where the mineral rights are taken underneath the house and the house subsides into the big hole that's left. Pennsylvania legislature said we don't like that, so we're going to require the coal companies to leave pillars of coal in place to eliminate subsidence. The coal companies sued, contending that the law requiring the pillars to be left in place was a takings of property under the Fifth Amendment, because it was a taking of coal that could not be harvested because it had to be left in place as a pillar to guard against mine subsidence. Court struck the law, holding that it was a takings and violated the corporation's constitutional rights. That's Pennsylvania Coal Company. 1970, Ross versus Bernard, once again not ancient history. Corporations received the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial in a civil case. So now in civil cases, corporations have Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial. 1976, the Buckley case, folks probably know about, especially Bo, I would assume, that money is speech. It's essentially the phrase that came out of Buckley in 76. Lesser known is that Buckley also codified, validated, and vindicated the fact that corporations have First Amendment rights to participate in electoral activity. Lesser known fact. 77, Bilotti case, which we went over, First Amendment case dealing with corporations where they overturned these laws eliminating corporate involvement in referenda. 1978, the Marshall case. This is a great case where corporations now have Fourth Amendment rights against surprise OSHA inspections because it was deemed to be a violation of due process for the corporations to be subjected to surprise inspections under the Fourth Amendment. Which brings us to the final case, 1996, on the timeline. It's a Second Circuit decision. It says Supreme Court, that's actually an error. It's a Second Circuit decision. International Dairy Foods Association versus Amistel. What happened in that case, the state of Vermont said BGH is probably not a really good thing for people to be drinking. This is the bovine growth hormone, the artificial hormone made by Monsanto that is injected into dairy cows to get them to produce more milk. And just as a side note, my experience with Monsanto came in the form of a priority mail envelope which contained 50 syringes full of a BGH. because that's how they get dairy farmers hooked on using BGH in their dairy farms, is Monsanto actually shipped them kits, which were full of syringes already full of BGH to be inserted into the cows. So, you know, drug pushers over here, you know, here's a little bit of crack, why don't you try it out? And here's priority mail envelopes, packages coming with syringes full of this stuff for dairy farmers to...
Why did you use it?
Yeah, did you inject your cows with it?